Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer. We have a twofer for you today. We are going to speak with Seth Kugel of the New York Times a bit later. He is the tripped up columnist, so he'll talk about things that are going wrong. But we're going to start with what's going right in travel today, and that is visiting London. It's a city that's forever evolving and changing, and so we update our guidebook there regularly. And the man who does that is Jason Cochran. He is also the editor-in-chief of Frommers.com. He just returned from London. And so I thought I'd grill him on what's new and happening there. So, hey, welcome back to the Frommer Travel Show, Jason.
Thanks very much. It's good to be back, but I'd also rather be in London.
Sorry about that. So, you'd rather be in London. It sounds like a lot of people would rather be in London. It was pretty crowded while you're there, right?
It's a busy summer in London. You know, tourism may be down in some other places, but it doesn't seem like it's very down in London. It just seemed packed during daytime hours and dinner hours pretty much every single day, but particularly on weekends. It was a very busy town. Food prices are up a little bit, as they seem to be everywhere.
Yeah.
Hotel prices, it's always pretty expensive in London, and it's not dipping. It hasn't been going down that much. They're pretty much holding high. So it's still a hot spot to be in, and everyone wants to be there.
Yeah. So hotel and restaurant prices are high, but one of the blessings of London is most of the great attractions are free, including a new attraction that you wrote about for Frommers.com that is associated with the Victoria and Albert Museum. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what's happening at the V&A right now.
Okay, so the Victoria and Albert Museum, for people who don't know, it was established, you know, during the Victorian period to basically be a repository for the world's greatest decorative arts. And at one point, they even made plaster models of all the great statues in Florence so that the poor people could look at them because they wouldn't be able to go. And they still have those plaster models for you and me, today's poor people, to go enjoy them at the Victoria and Albert Museum. But they've also launched a spin-off museum. They have a few of them all across the UK. There's a few in London. The newest spinoff is called the V&A East. When it says East, they mean East London, which is the other side of town from where the main V&A is. And it's basically a giant purpose-built warehouse for all the stuff they don't have room to show in the main V&A museum. And that's a huge museum. But what distinguishes the V&A East and why people are excited about it is before you visit it, you can go onto the website and see all the items they have. And many of the items are available for you to inspect by hand if you just make a reservation. So is there an ancient Balenciaga dress from, you know, the beginning days of fashion that you want to check out? Yeah, they'll probably be able to set you up with a time. You go at the time and the curator will come out and show you the item that you wanted to look at. And I say Balenciaga dress because that's one of the most popular requests. People are picking the fashion items quite a lot so they can copy them for their own weddings and things like that. But you can do anything that they have in the collection at the V&A East that's marked with a marker that says it's available to look at.
And like the V&A, it's free, right?
It's absolutely free. And the V&A is free. The V&A, the main V&A, will have exhibitions, very big blockbuster exhibitions. Like they've once had a big David Bowie thing. They had a dresses that divas wear. And these are always sellouts. And the latest sellout this year, it lasts until November, is one on Cartier, who is, of course, you know, the bespoke jeweler. And if a rich person has a bag full of jewels, they go to Cartier and say, "Will you make me something exquisite out of my jewels?" And they do. These are things you just cannot find in shops. And they have the most spectacular spectacular exhibition on all the many of the different things that Cartier has made over the years, things that Consuelo Vanderbilt wore, she of course being the model for Gladys on the Gilded Age, things that the queen and the queen mum wore, crowns and pins that sultans wore in their turbans, a lot of tiaras. It is the very ring that Grace Kelly wore in High Society, which was her actual engagement ring to Prince Rainier, they have in this display. The bangles that
loaned, I guess. Right?
All loaned. You can see the bangles that Gloria Swanson wore in Sunset Boulevard. They belonged to Gloria Swanson. She wore them as the character, which, of course, back in the day, many major Hollywood film actors would do. They would just wear their own jewels in the movies. And Cartier exhibit was fascinating. I'm not a guy who loves what the super rich do, and I want to follow everything they do, but you cannot help but be absolutely stunned at the craftsmanship of the stuff that you see under glass there.
Interesting. So if somebody is going to London for the first time, and they're going to be going to the Tower of London, which involves gazing at a lot of jewelry.
The crown jewels in that case.
Yes. Would you still recommend the Cartier, or is this for somebody who's
You're not going to see this stuff. Most of the stuff is in private collections and just is here for this exhibition. Crown jewels are always going to be there because that's where they're kept in between the state, you know, appointment, the state visits and the grand rituals. They're kept at the Tower. You can see those almost any time you go to the Tower. They get you on a conveyor belt and you move right past them, but it's enough time. But in the Cartier exhibit in the V&A, you'll see stuff that you're not ever going to see again. It's really cool.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
It was all sold out, the Cartier exhibit. I wanted to go to the Cartier exhibit. They had no tickets. But if you become a member of the V&A, which is a little over $100, you can get into exhibitions for free and without a ticket. So if you do go to London and there's an exhibition you really wanted to see, but you can't find any tickets, which is very common because these exhibitions are very popular, see if you might want to become a member of that place and if we'll get you in, because it worked for me.
Okay. So do we know, is the Cartier sold out through November?
Yeah, it can be really tricky to get a ticket, especially if you don't plan at least a month ahead. Though some of these exhibitions they've done in the past, like on Bowie, completely jammed, sold out. You couldn't get in. So yeah. So you if there's an exhibition you want to see at like the National Gallery or the V&A or any of the major museums that are otherwise free, you might have to pay for that exhibition and you should double check that there are tickets available for the day you intend to go.
Interesting. Okay. You also went to a teeny tiny, should I call it a jewel box of a museum? Well, I don't know if I'm making a pun there. It's probably a bad one. It is the Vagina Museum.
I'm going to let you make the puns here. I'm going to be very careful when I choose my words because it's actually a very intelligent, it's a handmade space. These are people who have gotten together who want to remind people about the various ways that our systems sort of disadvantage women and don't talk about one of the organs that half the population of the world possesses.
Right.
They make very interesting points, in the scholarship of this museum. One of them is that when they had a lot of witch trials, of course, back in the 17th centuries, often the mood swings that they would characterize as typical of witches could also be typified as like a mood swing that might be typical of menopause. But people don't talk about menopause. And so this museum very rightly raises the possibility that some women were possibly being accused of witches when they were just going through the change. And this is representative of the kind of unfairness that women need to face all the time when people aren't openly discussing their biological realities. And this museum sort of aims to, on a very homespun basis, it's in a vault in East London, underneath the railway, and signs are handmade, exhibitions are handmade, to try to remedy some of this. So let's talk about this incredibly important organ that so many people have. So it's actually a pretty interesting museum. Their gift shop was fantastic.
Oh, well, we'll talk about the gift shop in a second, but are there vaginas on display in art?
And they warn you about it because not everyone likes to see pieces of people. But yes, there is, you'll find an organ inside a jar so that they can label it and explain, what's what. And it is part of the exhibition. So yes, they do take a serious approach as they can for a museum that a bunch of people got together and decided to create to fill a gap. You'll find museums about the male organ in cities, in other cities. I think Iceland, Reykjavik has famously had one where people they'll spend lots of money and get their pictures taken. It's a little bit of a gag. And the Vagina Museum is not like that. It really wants you to take it seriously because it takes itself seriously.
Interesting. Well, does it take itself seriously in the gift shop?
Not in the gift shop. Really great designs, like beautiful designs based on, but like great mugs. And they even have like cuddly stuffed creatures, or I guess they're creatures, that are based on the organ. Fascinating. Yeah. And it's kind of a very interesting place to buy some souvenirs. I bought someone some coasters that looked at first like a flower, but turned out was not a flower.
So that'll be in the next edition of Fromer's London. What else will be new in the next edition? I know you went on a bunch of different tours that you may be adding.
Always trying to check up on the tours and make sure there's something we still want to include. I took a bunch. One of them I want to tell people about are the Hidden London Tours. They're run by the London Transport Museum, which is a fantastic space in Covent Garden that surveys the tube, the buses, the trams, the whole history of public transit in London, which is iconic and important. And they go to spaces that are normally closed to the public. Often this is in the form of abandoned tube stops. And I've taken a couple of them in the past. One of them I took a tube stop that was used by Churchill during the Blitz as sort of a command center. He hated being down there because it was dirty, but it's been preserved very much as it was in those days. The tour I took this time was Aldwych Tube Stop, which has been shut down for about 31 years, but is now often used for filming. So whenever you see something shot on the underground these days, V for Vendetta is an example of a movie, Darkest Hour, the Churchill movie is another one. They use this station so they can stay down there and shoot as long as they want without disturbing things. So it's pretty cool to go into the stop that is pretty unchanged from the old days.
They have old advertisements on the walls.
They do. Yeah, there's two different platforms. One of them has always been used as their test out platform designs by sticking things in this and seeing how it looks. And so they have a lot of antique posters that they've used in that process. Or they have it in the second platform. It changes for what production is probably most recently in there. So when I was in there, there was a lot of Blitz-related stuff. And this tube station really was used during the Blitz as a shelter. At the time, it was the closest shelter to Bush House, which was the head of the BBC. So often a lot of the propaganda films were shot there to make it look like everyone was super happy. And yeah, the Blitz doesn't faze us. So whenever you watch sort of like staged, well-lit old newsreels of people in the underground during the Blitz, it might be the Aldwych station back in the 1940-41. Very cool.
Wow. Yeah, that is cool. And you also did a food tour, right? How was that?
Eating London. They do a bunch. They do a lot in Europe too, but they do a particular interesting ones in London. The one I took this time was of Soho, which is sort of like a nightlife district sort of in the middle of the West End. And it was a pretty fascinating tour. They took us to all different types of cuisine from all around the world, really interesting cocktails, and wrapped up with a giant gooey cookie. We had about 7 stops, but we had bao, we had Burmese, we had sort of like this fusion Indian stuff. It was just really interesting stuff. And of course, some British wines and cheese as well. So if you really want to get a good look at Soho and be guided around to spots you might not have known otherwise, the Eating London Tour really was a great way to spend a few hours.
You also went to a place that didn't used to be open to the public. I'm talking about the Speaker's House in the Parliament Building. Tell our listeners what that is and what you see.
All right, the Parliament Building, you know where the Big Ben Tower is and where Parliament is. It's right there on the river. It happens to be an extension of what has been an ancient palace. The oldest room in that area, in that complex, is from 1099. It's called Westminster Hall. And if you saw when Queen Elizabeth II lied in state and all the people filed past her, that's Westminster Hall. It's one of the oldest buildings in London, if not the world, right? Obviously, that it's such ancient hammer beam roof from the 1400s. Very cool. That is part of the entire Parliament complex. And in recent years, the entire Parliament complex has been adding extra tours that weren't available to Americans before or anyone else outside the UK. A couple of years ago, they added tours up to Big Ben, which is the bell, at the main Big Bell at the very top of the tower. And you can stand under that thing as it rings on the Big Ben tour. You just have to take all the steps up there's no elevator. That's one of the tours they added. In the old days, Americans weren't allowed to go because it was only open to people who had a member of Parliament representing them, who would give them the invitation. They've recently opened it. But the most recent addition to the Parliament tours is the Speaker's House, which is right there on the corner of Westminster Bridge Road and the river. And it's where the Speaker of the House of Commons usually lives. And the current speaker lives there, the previous one did. And it's this whole giant section of Parliament. So he can be steps away from his work. And you're allowed to walk through many of the public rooms that he uses on state visits or dining. You go past the portraits of all of the prime ministers over the years, see how they've changed. It's a fascinating place. And, most of the great world leaders have been in this space, had meetings in this space, and you're allowed now. to go through and learn about it as well. And this only is usually offered when House of Commons and Parliament is not sitting. So summertime's a good time to do it. You need to plan ahead to make sure Parliament isn't sitting if you want to do it. But Big Ben, I think, is available pretty much otherwise.
So if Parliament is sitting, I guess the Speaker is probably in residence there. And he's,
yeah, that's right. Exactly right. And it's good to go when Parliament isn't sitting anyway, because then you can actually tour the House of Commons and tour the House of Lords and go through all of those incredible old spaces, which I also did on this trip. But that's been available for a little bit of time now. But it's super cool to see how their system of government works. They don't sit at their desks and vote with a button the way people might in the U.S. It's called division there. And if you're voting yes, you walk over to one lobby. If you're voting no, you walk over to another lobby, and that's where your vote is registered. So it's a physical way to vote in the UK. And in fact, you know, people who are members of Parliament might go to some pub a couple blocks away. And in the old days, when they had 8 minutes to get back and get into the correct lobby for their vote, and a bell would go off in the pub, they'd know to put their beers down and run over to Parliament. Now they've got an app that will tell them. But those are the sorts of things that you learn, and plus all the incredible, beautiful art and stained glass and sculptures that have been in this building, which was built, I think, in the 1840s. So it's a beautiful tour to take.
Right. And that wasn't the only historic house you went to. We're calling it a house. It's the House of Parliament. You went to is it fair to say the suburbs of London?
It was once the suburbs. It's Ealing, which is in West London. You know, I think 20th century people know Ealing from its old comedies and the films they shot there. This house, you know, was built much before that. In fact, it was there during the early version of it was there during the reign of King Henry VIII. And it's, in fact, the main room, I think it's the long gallery of Sion House, which is the house we're talking about, was where Lady Jane Grey found out that she was going to be queen, which only lasted 9 days, unfortunately for her. But though this is a big part of history. And in the 1820s, it's where Queen Victoria, then Princess Victoria, would be shipped off to go to the country, even though it's only about 8 miles west of Buckingham Palace. To get out of the city and basically kind of get out of the clutches of her mother, what she would try to do the most. And she spent 7 summers there, and she just absolutely loved it and became very close to the family who ran the house at the time. I think it was the Duke of Northumberland. And now you can still tour this house and see how it fronts the Thames and see all the incredible books and sculptures and obviously very, very ancient architecture and interior design. It's not like the Buckingham Palace where there's lots of money to keep it going. A family owns this, and so they run tours, and they live in another part of the house when they're in London. But the tours help fund the upkeep of this incredible house, which is sort of how a lot of these old houses now have to operate. The Downton Abbey, Highclere Castle, being another great example.
Yeah, that's open to visitors. That's not in London, though, we should say.
No, that's about an hour west of London in Newbury. It's an easy day trip, and we tell how in the Frommer's Guide.
Before I let you go, you went and saw something that, for some reason, every ad on or every clip on my social media feed keeps showing clips of Rachel Zegler. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correct.
You are.
Standing on a balcony in the West End, dressed as Evita. To me, she's not old enough to play Evita. I would think she would be the mistress, but never mind. This is becoming a very famous Evita. How was it?
Yeah, what we're talking about is like she actually performs the song Don't Cry for Me, Argentina on the balcony of the theater, but to the world. So anyone who wants to can come into the Argyle Street at the appointed time, stand behind a barrier and listen to her sing the song live. And all these cameras are around the balcony so that everyone sitting in the theater watching the show that this is a part of can see on a massive, massive screen that takes up the entire stage what she's doing basically to charm and lie to the people outside about how wonderful she is in that song. And you can see her sort of, you know, bamboozle the people from this. It's a very fascinating way to handle the song because normally it's all done inside the theater. And people come by the hundreds now to watch her do this 8 times a week. And you don't even need a ticket. You don't have to pay for anything. You stand outside. This is only until, I think, late September or so. And it might go to New York, but I have no idea which theater they're going to use for that.
But you saw her inside the theater.
Yeah, I went to see it. First, I saw inside the theater, what it was like from the inside.
And you didn't feel gypped that
no,
the big song wasn't in front of you?
I think it's social media nonsense. It's just, I've seen a lot of people, a lot of articles on social media saying people are so upset that she's doing this for the public and they paid. I didn't see a single person inside the theater who cared. In fact, most people will probably do both. If you have a ticket to the show, you might go see her do it outside too. But everyone in the theater seemed to think that it was super cool and was kind of tickled by the whole originality of the way it felt and looked.
Right.
It's a high energy show. Yeah, she is incredible. She's the real deal. She can sing. She has got energy for days. Yeah. And her Che, Diego Andres Rodriguez, is pretty spectacular too.
So she's good at
it. You know, is a messy show, but it's sort of like a rock concert with tons of energy and dancing more than it is a coherent thing. But that's just writing. That's not this show. It was a lot of fun to go see.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
And what a great old theater to do it, because the London Palladium, one of the most important theaters in London. It's, you know, Judy Garland had her famous shows there.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's one of these theaters that feels like it's still lit by gaslight with cherub faces carved into the walls. It's a very, very cool space.
Oh boy. Well, you've really made me want to go back to London, Jason. I got to say, thank you so, so much as always for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show. Things go wrong on vacation, and nobody knows that better than Seth Kugel. He is the tripped-up columnist for the New York Times. People write to him about the most hair-raising things that go wrong on vacation, and he tries to help them. And he does a great job, which is why I'm so pleased to have him back on the Frommer Travel Show. Hey, Seth, lovely to speak with you.
Hey, Pauline, and it's always about something so positive, right?
Yeah. Well, what I liked about your latest column is it's a situation that I don't think, knock wood, will happen to many people, just in terms of a plane having really, really bad mechanical issues and having to stop at a speck of an island in the middle of the Atlantic. But there were a lot of issues that came up that touch on things that average travelers will experience. So tell us the story first of what happened to the person who wrote to you.
Sure. A Delta flight was on its way from Madrid to New York City, and they had engine problems. One of the two engines malfunctioned and had to be shut down. So it was an Airbus. I don't know the model, and I wouldn't know what that meant anyway, but these big jets can fly on one engine. It's not like this plane was going down, but because one engine is, you know, it's still a little risky. What if sometimes the other engine, they turned and they landed in the nearest spot they could, which was Terceira Island in the Azores, which, by the way, is used to this kind of flight. If you look it up, it or Iceland gets a lot of these planes with some sort of trouble that need to land. They landed. It is a small island, but there is an Air Force base there. They do have a good runway for emergency landings. Everything went fine. But what the person wrote into me to complain about is that Delta did not communicate very much with the passengers, and they were sort of shepherded into a very small area in this airport, which was already very small. And we're sort of stuck there waiting for information. Would there be a replacement flight? Would it leave tonight? Should they get a hotel room? Would Delta pay for the hotel room? And then, of course, people react differently to we lost an engine. And some people were understandably quite panicked at the whole routine. And others, you know, were a little bit calmer. Some were panicked at being on this small island. Others realized, oh, this is an island in the European Union. You know, it's not a... there are facilities here. So in any case, the bottom line is, it is true that Delta did not communicate very effectively with the passengers. Now, of course, Delta does not have any staff on this island, but I think the main complaint was their messages via text, via email, and over the phone when people called were sort of contradictory and didn't reach everybody. So,
right. And you know that because you not only took the letter from this one traveler, you, in typical New York Times fashion, you did the research, you reached out to half a dozen other passengers to see if their experiences jived with what this guy wrote about. And in certain ways, sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't.
To be clear, I reached out to much more than half a dozen passengers, but it's hard to find people. And, you know, people were posting on Reddit, and then you write to them on Reddit, but it's not their real name. So I talked to six parties, I would say, that were, aside from the guy who wrote, because the person who writes doesn't always have the whole story right. He might not have the full information. And it turned out that some people did receive better communications than others. Some people received compensation much more quickly than the guy who wrote in. But it was a very inconsistent performance, it seems, would be the best way I would put it, by Delta. And the question I sort of was asking myself is, why isn't there some protocol, like the minute the plane lands in the Azores, to say, hey, everybody, we're really sorry this happened. We're glad you're safe. Here's what the next hours will bring. We don't know exactly when we'll get you out of there, but we're working hard on it. If you do have to stay over, we will get you a hotel. If you do have to buy meals, we will reimburse you. We have your back. And that would have gone a long way. They did send out something that had some of that information to some people about an hour plus after the flight landed. But I don't see why is it so hard to send a text to everybody?
Yeah.
Maybe some people won't get it because, you know, they have one member of your party only, the contact information, and maybe your cell phone ran out of a battery. But most people should have gotten some.
Right. No, that was what was so surprising, that there wasn't a standardized response, that people got offered different compensations for this. Some people heard from the airline within an hour. Some people didn't hear from them till the next day.
Yeah.
Why was the response so scattershot, do you think? Does it have to do with how people booked? Maybe people who used a third party didn't get, you know, contacted as easily as people who booked through the airline? Or is there any explanation?
That's a very good theory. Some people theorize it's the people that have the higher status on the airline. But of course, that wouldn't make any sense, because why would you not send it out to everybody? You wouldn't say, oh, you've had an emergency landing. Let's let the gold medallion people know first. I don't think you would do that. But it is possible that they didn't have all the right contact information, although you'd think they would. Everyone got their reservation via email.
Yeah.
It's not like they didn't have the email. So it's just one of these things. The airlines have these very complex communication systems. They work in different ways for different airlines. I don't have any insight into what happens inside the airline when they make these decisions. It just strikes me there should be some system that falls right into place. Another thing people mentioned regularly to me was that when they did call Delta, the people on the other end, who of course are, who knows, one of thousands of customer service representatives, didn't immediately know what this was all about. So isn't there some way to flag when there's a diverted flight that would pop up in every customer service agent's computer as soon as the person calls in, tied to their telephone number? Of course, this is probably way more complex than I imagine it to be. But as I say in the article, like literally the sign, what airlines do all day is deal with these kind of complexities. So it seems like it could have gone a lot better.
Yeah. And what pissed off a lot of passengers was they weren't getting talked to by Delta, but suddenly the crew marches out of the airport. Clearly, they're going to a hotel. So Delta has been in contact with them and is making sure they're taken care of. Why is there a logical reason for that?
I mean, there's a logical reason, but I wouldn't say it's correct. I mean, they're of course talking to the crew the whole time anyway, and the protocol is to get the crew out of there. It's unclear whether it's because they need to debrief them on what happened, or what Delta said was they needed to get them to a hotel so they could begin their rest in case they were needed to fly the return flight. But I actually am not sure that's the case. I talked to a couple of airline experts who said there was probably some sort of debriefing involved where they speak to everyone. I don't really know what happened. At the end of the day, they didn't really need to rest because the crew of the flight that came in with another aircraft rested, and then they all left the next evening after about 29 hours.
Oh, so I thought it had to do with the rest period, which made sense to me.
I mean, all I'm saying, that's what Delta said, but then I don't know. I don't know what the protocols are. I do know that from a person's, personal perspective, you just landed with all these Delta crew. It sort of makes logical sense to a passenger. Well, there are Delta staff on this island. It's the crew. Why can't we speak to them? Obviously, the airline has a whole other protocol, and I can't really speak to how necessary that is. But at the very least, if the crew is going to be whisked away, you would expect the passengers to have some contact with Delta. I will also say, in Delta's defense, they did immediately contract. They have a pre-existing relationship with this airport because so many flights end up there. Staff members from the airport were immediately there in yellow vests and apparently were very, very nice and very, very patient. You know, it takes a certain kind of human being to have the superhuman patience you need when there's 280 panicked people all asking you questions at once. They apparently did very well, but they took a while to get the information out, and it was several hours. Now, this is a complicated situation. They couldn't let the people leave the airport because without an immigration officer there, because they're entering the European Union. They've been checked out of the European Union in Madrid. Now they're entering again, and this airport only has international flights like once in a while. So they don't have 24-hour immigration staff.
Oh, wow.
So they had to find the immigration staff, get them to the airport before these folks could even leave. That's not Delta's fault, obviously. But, it also took a while. By the time Delta had figured out what hotels were available, and there were plenty of hotels available, it's kind of a resort island. Most people had already made their own bookings.
Yeah, and they're getting reimbursed for those. In fact, to me, that's the kernel of the story. The takeaway is this flight, because it was from the European Union, was under EU rules in terms of compensation. And not everybody who you talk to got the same compensation. And they could have if they knew to look at the rules, if they hadn't been contacted by a New York Times, yes, reporter saying, oh, you didn't get that? So it's really a great idea to know what the governing rules are.
And the rule is that if you're on a flight like this, the airline needs to tell you right away that you get this compensation. Now, the airline did, I talked to seven people, but seven groups, basically, because one person was representing everyone else. And four of the seven had already heard from Delta. They already had gotten their compensation within a few days. So clearly Delta was fine with them. A fifth person had just not seen the email and admitted to me later that when I told them about the compensation, they actually went back and found the email about it. But then there were the two people who didn't hear about the compensation. One went after the compensation himself. The other literally hadn't heard about it and had to go back to Delta and say, what? You gave us $250 credit. Everyone else got $640 credit plus the EU stuff. Now, again, I don't know what happened inside of Delta. They declined to comment on the specific questions about this communication.
Right.
And there might be a very reasonable explanation. There might not be, but still.
And just so people know, the airline always has to compensate you or at least house you for free if it's their fault. And this time, it wasn't a storm that made this plane land early. It was a mechanical problem, which is, by law, their fault.
And by the way, we're never going to know the answer to should someone have caught this engine problem before the plane took off. That's just something we're not going to know. The passengers, of course, think maybe they could have caught it. The airline they went through all the checks. This wasn't apparent. So that's just a whole question that we'll never get an answer to. Giving the airline credit, they do, of course, Delta has a good safety record. I'm sure they checked everything they were supposed to check. But, is this something they could have figured out? Who knows?
Who knows? Well, it was a really fascinating article, as always. Thank you so much, Seth, for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show. And that is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, lucky you, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Thank you. Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I, I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.